Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
Today we're going to dive into some listener mail, and we actually have two different Carney the Mailbots here to help us today. The one on the left here is just bright silver, gleaming like a suit of armor from the movie Excalibur. And then the one on the right resembles a rusty death bucket,
like a suit of armor from Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yeah, that's pretty much what he looks like.
How did we get two Carneys in these two different states?
Well, it's because we did that massive upgrade on Carney. You know, we started replacing some of his parts, upgrading a part here, a part there, and then we just kept doing it. And then on the other end, when we were done the used parts, we just started assembling those as well until we had two complete Carneys. The Carney in which we had replaced every last piece with a new shiny piece, and then the Carney that we built out of the old pieces.
Now, the question is, which Carney is going to deliver us this week's listener mail?
I'm just going to close my eyes and put my hand out and I guess hope that I don't get pricked by the rusty one, just because I'm not sure my tetanus shots are up to date.
Fun fact, rust does not cause tetanus.
Does it not? Well, there you go. So it's okay that he has razor-sharp, rusty claws.
It's A-okay, right?
All right.
Now, unfortunately, no matter what, we never have time to read all of the great listener mail we get. So if you've sent us a message and we haven't been able to respond and you don't hear it on the show today, please don't be discouraged. It's not because we don't appreciate the mail we get. There's just a lot of great stuff out there and no time to attend to it all. But we really do appreciate all the wonderful communiques we get from you lovely people out there.
Yeah, because even though we have twice the Carney now, we only still have the two of us. So there's only so much we can do.
And there's only so much time.
That's right.
Let's jump right in, Robert.
All right, let's do it. I'm going to put out my hand. It looks like Shiny Carney is bringing me something to read here. All right, this one comes to us from Alex. Alex says, "Hi, Robert and Joe. Your podcast is wonderful, and although it was already very good to begin with, I feel you two are getting even better and better."
Oh,
yeah, because we keep replacing parts. That's what's happening. Keep up the great work. We're big fans. I have a comment about the Ship of Theseus episode. I'm a particle physicist by training, so I was thinking about your discussion a bit from that perspective. I don't claim to have any definite answers, but I think the theory of quantum mechanics adds more depth and weirdness to the problem of identity on top of what you've already discussed. In quantum mechanics, different particles of the same type are treated as truly indistinguishable. Two particles can be separated in space, but in the theory, they are described by one wave function, which simply features a high probability to find a particle in region A, as well as a high probability to find a particle in region B, with no mention that it's particle Alice here and that it's particle Bob there. My tentative takeaway is this. If a quantum teleportation machine were to transfer the quantum state of the atoms in my body sitting in place A onto a stream of photons and then transfer that onto atoms in a place B a mile away, I don't see a real justification to treat the newly created atoms a mile away as anything other than truly the parts of my own body which have been moved there. I still feel a bit queasy to hand over my fate to this machine, but rationally, I'd love to hear a discussion of these quantum physics aspects of the ship of Theseus sometime. Cheers, Alex.
Now, that is an interesting question because there's this obvious preference people have that like, oh, if I'm going to be teleported and it'll still be me, I want the particles that originally made my body to be the same particles that make up the copy of me. Now, that's if you're teleporting information about your body from one place to another, that's just probably not going to be the case, right? You're going to have to build from different particles. And Alex is saying, why would that really make a difference? I don't know if that really would make a difference. I would think that the problem would be the interruption of the continuous existence of you from during that moment of transition.
Basically what I said before, where you just need somebody to lie to you about that interruption.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you need somebody to just to gloss over the more problematic details of your teleportation system.
So I think you said this before. You'd rather live in a world where people are teleporting. They are just actually dying every time they do it, but nobody knows it.
Well, but you, I guess the positive spin is you're not only dying, you're being reborn. I mean, this is kind of what what Seth Brundle was talking about in Cronenberg's The Fly, the idea that it's like there's a purifying aspect to the teleportation. I believe this was some of what he was talking about before things began going terribly wrong for him, you know, mixing his DNA with that of a fly.
But is being reborn worthwhile if you don't know you're being reborn? Say, for example, people say, mm-hmm. you know, I'd love to be able to go back and start over my life again, to do it right this time. But if you were to go back and start over without the memory of your previous life, how would anything – why would that be any better? Why would that change anything? It seems like the value of being reborn is the knowledge of what came before and the knowledge that you have been reborn.
Or just the idea that you've been reborn. I mean, somebody could just fool you into thinking teleportation is possible. You walk into a box, there's some lights, you walk out of the box, but if you feel renewed, right, then it could have an overall positive effect. Speaking of Cronenberg, I don't know if you've read about this as well, but supposedly David Cronenberg has a screenplay that he wrote that is a sequel to The Fly that doesn't necessarily contain any monsters. That's more about – I don't know that there are any more additional details out there, but it is more concerned with teleportation itself than it is with any kind of monstrous side effects of the technology.
Oh, I think you could write a great psychological horror movie purely about teleportation without any like DNA fusion or, you know, becoming half fly or anything like that.
Yeah. It's one of my hopes that – either Cronenberg will get to direct that script or somebody will one day direct that script. I'm very interested what he's exploring in that. Because we're also talking about later day Cronenberg.
Mm-hmm.
Cronenberg who hasn't really been dipping his toes into the squeamish horror content of his earlier filmography.
So the more recent Cronenberg version, it's just got a bunch of like mafia guys who get into a teleporter together and they come out having an existential crisis.
I'd probably be down for that. I do love so many of the transcendent ideas that were at least briefly discussed in The Fly, like the idea towards the end that not only is he going to cure himself by climbing into the telepod with Gina Davis's character, you know, but they will become one perfect being, you know, that there's this fusion that will take place that will create a higher human.
Yeah, and that embodies some of the questions, I guess, about the whole teleportation idea. Like, to him, that's an idea of, like, addition or becoming better, and to her, that's obviously an idea of obliteration or destruction.
Yeah.
Okay, also about the Ship of Theseus, this comes to us from our listener, Anne. Anne writes, "Hi, Robert and Joe. I'm a longtime listener of your show and am writing in to respond to your great episode on the Ship of Theseus. I'd never heard of the mythic iteration of this concept, but I'm familiar with it from the Romantic poets of England. I wouldn't be surprised if they built off of it from some of the philosophers you mentioned, including Hobbes. In a September 1819 letter to his brother and sister-in-law, John Keats," that's the Romantic poet, "John Keats takes a personal and religious approach to the question. I've included the excerpt here. Quote, 'From the time you left me, our friends say I have altered completely, am not the same person. Perhaps in this letter I am, for in a letter one takes up one's existence from the time we last met. I dare say you have altered also. Every man does. Our bodies every 7 years are completely fresh materialed. 7 years ago, it was not this hand that clinched itself against Hammond. We are like the relict garments of a saint, the same and not the same, for the careful monks patch it and patch it for St. Anthony's shirt."
Ooh, that's nice.
Well, yeah, I like that that brings in an idea. So if you believe, for example, that an item can be holy— Mm-hmm. That's another question about identity. Imagine you say you believe in like a piece of the true cross or something, one of these medieval relics, and it's gradually losing splinters but having splinters replaced by people who are working on it. Once the entire thing has been replaced, it does it still have holy power?
Well, this is why you notice it in some of the museums that you go to. There'll be a tiny vial of vampire blood inside the temperature control compartment with it so they can see just how holy the artifact still is.
That'd be a good test.
Yeah.
Anne continues, "I love that this section gets into different layers of identity, both the one self-reported and or time-traveled to, e.g., quote, taking up one's existence from the time we last met, unquote, and also the one created by others, as in the monks reconstructing the relic, ironically in trying to preserve the original. This also touches on the biological transformation that you mentioned in the podcast, the 7 to 10 year recreation of the cells in the body. As for identity being defined by the static reality of an object or its constant evolution in a process, Shelley weighs in with a poem called Mutability, which concludes on the following stanzas." So this is Percy Bysshe Shelley. "We rest. A dream has power to poison sleep. We rise. One wandering thought pollutes the day. We feel, conceive, or reason, laugh, or weep, embrace fond woe, or cast our cares away. It is the same, for, be it joy or sorrow, the path of its departure still is free. Man's yesterday may ne'er be like his morrow. Naught may endure but mutability." To me, that embodies very much the idea of the Heraclitus type idea, panterae, everything flows, it's all flux, it's all change. But Anne continues, "While he's maybe talking more about emotional states here than comprehensive identity, the final thought of the poem sides with the argument that existence is defined by transformation, which brings up the question of whether or not change itself can be defined as a constant. Anyways, just some tie-ins from yet another realm. I love your show and the curious exuberance with which it addresses these potentially terrifying existential questions. Thanks a lot. Thanks for a lot of great listening. Sincerely, Anne." Thank you so much, Anne. I always love when people come at us with poetry.
Yes, and I particularly like the specimens that she presented us with there. I want to skip to another bit of listener mail here that came to us about the Ship of Theseus, and this came to us from Diana. Diana writes, "Hi, Robert and Joe. I've been listening for a while, sometimes by myself, sometimes with the kids. Recently, my 7-year-old daughter and I were listening to the Ship of Theseus episode, and I thought I'd ask her the question, if you had a toy and replaced all the parts of that toy with new, different parts, would it be the same toy? Her unequivocal answer was yes. When I asked why it would be the same and not different, her response was, because it's the same toy. The new parts don't make it different." Yeah, so there you go. From the mouths of babes. Love the show. Diana. I really like this this email because it reminds me of the whole scenario of of replacing a lost toy, which is something that I imagine a number of you have experienced as a child, or perhaps you've played a part in the scenario as a parent. But obviously, when you replace a toy, especially if it's a stuffed animal, the replacement can often look just like a completely different species compared to the like the worn out thing that you had to replace. You know, like it becomes essentially the rusty carny. Like the rusty carny is the one you love, and then when you're presented with this brand new untarnished carny, you're like, that's not carny. You know, that's not Socks the Bear. Socks the Bear has only one eye, and his fur isn't bright and fluffy. It's matted and gray. Like it's the wear and the tear that is part and partial to the identity of the thing.
But it sounds like Diana's child is saying maybe that it's not, right? That like even if you do replace all of the body parts of Socks the Bear with newer, fresher body parts, it's the same bear.
Yeah, so maybe this is just me like looking back on childhood experiences and looking at my own child's experiences through the eyes of a parent. Yeah, maybe that ultimately doesn't matter to the kid. They're like, yeah, Socks is great now. Look at him. He's doing great. He's wonderful. He looks like he's brand new. Exactly what I wanted.
You know, with the kind of unreality of childhood, the kind of hallucinatory quality of the child's view of the world, I can almost imagine that I could have been a little kid and had some of my toys replaced with clearly newer versions of themselves, and I wonder if I would have noticed or if I would have thought anything was unusual or if I just would have thought, hey, it's even better now.
Well, sometimes the function would be improved, right? Like,
yeah.
Like I remember having two Boba Fetts. There was the original Boba Fett that I played with so much that he couldn't stand up anymore. Mm-hmm. Like his limited joints were just – they would just swivel around. So he could only like lay down. That was it. Or, you know, he could fly through the air, I guess. But it was only the newer Boba Fett that could actually stand upright.
Which was more important?
I think ultimately standing upright was more important. The floppy Boba Fett had limited usage.
Okay, here's one from our listener and frequent contributor, Jim, writing also about the ship of Theseus. Jim writes, Robert and Joe, one can visit a real-life ship of Theseus in Boston, the USS Constitution, Old Ironsides. She is the oldest commissioned naval vessel still afloat. She makes at least one, quote, turnaround trip in the Boston Harbor every year, where they take her out and dock her back again in the opposite side for even more wear and tear while docked. I was in Boston in the early 1990s, where she was under major renovations. She was barely a hull and timbers from what I remember. About a dozen years later, I visited again when she was fully restored and beautiful. I asked our guide on the tour how much of the ship was original. He said about 15% is original, mostly below the waterline. He then motioned toward the bow of the ship toward the sick deck. I don't know what a sick deck is. Anyway, sick deck, and said, quote, "Do you see those brass nuts and bolts in the bulkhead? They were made by Paul Revere." I was impressed. Huh. He mentions that Malcolm Gladwell talked about the ship of Theseus in an episode of the Revisionist History podcast.
Yes, and I do remember listening to that one now. I believe he was this was the golf episode.
Yeah, he explains it. So Jim writes, this was an episode about golf courses on California. California property taxes are based upon the value of your property when you purchased it, not on current value. This was to prevent retired couples who owned their houses from being forced to move due to taxes when the value of their home skyrocketed. But what about the Golf Country Club? Who owns them? They are owned by the members, much like the members of a credit union. But when does membership change so as to recalculate the tax? The tax regulators determined that an individual member leaving or joining was not enough of a change to trigger a new property value. Therefore, the golf courses are taxed at their property values from decades ago, even if the entire membership from those original days has completely turned over. Given this logic, the Theseus Country Club never changes its ownership, especially for tax purposes, even if the entire membership turns over multiple times over the decade. And then he also has a PS with some Star Trek transporter issues. I don't know. We could get into those. Maybe. Maybe not.
Sure. I'm positive that our producer Alex would prefer that we get into these teleportation issues from Trek.
So Jim writes, in the old show, some sort of cosmic dust causes Kirk to reassemble twice on the transporter. He was split into good and evil. It was their Jekyll and Hyde homage.
Yeah.
In The Next Generation, Riker is found stranded as an outcast on a wasteland of a planet. But hasn't he been on the Enterprise for years? He had been on the barren planet when with a previous ship before the Next Generation started. When beamed up from the previous assignment, his signal was split by something in the atmosphere. One copy materialized on his ship. The other bounced back to the surface of the planet where he rematerialized, but no one knew. The stranded Riker wasn't too pleased that no one had come looking for him.
Oh, man. What if that just happened? It turns out it just happens all the time. Like one out of every five teleportations in Star Trek ends up shooting a random copy of you either to the surface of a deserted planet or into the walls.
It is a galaxy full of like Kirks and the red shirt away parties.
Now, this next one he mentions is one of the episodes I remember the most from watching Star Trek The Next Generation as a kid. And yet I totally forgot about this whole, teleportation Ship of Theseus angle.
Right. Jim writes, in The Next Generation, the Dyson Sphere episode, we meet Mr. Scott from the old show, but he hasn't aged from the movies, which took place decades previously. How? He had put himself into a form of stasis, I don't remember exactly why, which placed him in an infinite disassemble/assemble cycle, basically freezing time until he was found.
Huh. Yeah, see, I forgot all about that. Because it's a pretty distracting aspect of that episode that there is a Dyson sphere. And if you were like me, you've never encountered that concept before. It was pretty mind-blowing, enough so that it overshadowed the sort of glitching teleporter mishaps of Dr. Scott here.
Mr. Scott, I believe.
Is it Mr. Scott? See, I was never a classic Trek guy. I'm not sure what his credentials are.
I've been lashed by our fans enough about not having sufficient Trek knowledge.
General Scott.
That's correct. That's correct. Admiral Dr. Scott, DDS. One last note. In Voyager, two characters' information was mixed somehow. It wasn't a 50-50 mix. It was more like a 60-40 mix. In both cases, the 60% personality wasn't too keen on sharing their bodies with the other 40%. I only saw this episode once, and when it originally aired, I think the two characters were male and female. I have a memory that they cast two different actors to play each so as to make the fusion even more realistic.
Oh, nice.
I don't usually think of Star Trek as realistic, but...
Well, it explored a lot of territory. I will say this. I am definitely pro-Star Trek, especially Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and I'm not really a fan of golf. So I will say... Check out Star Trek by all means, but also check out that Malcolm Gladwell revisionist history episode about golf. He promises at the beginning that he says that he hates golf, and that by the end of the episode, he thinks that you'll hate golf as well. And I think I did hate golf even more after listening to that episode. It's a great podcast. It just fills you with insightful rage. It's great for road trips.
Okay, maybe we should look at a couple more Ship of Theseus mails.
All right, here's another one. This one comes to us from Marcos. Love your podcast. I have to say it's my favorite way of passing time on my commute. The conversation and conjecture turn a mundane daily trip into a timeless voyage.
Aw.
I was voyaging on your Ship of Theseus episode when it occurred to me that our Constitution, by this he means the U.S. Constitution, has in a way become a document of Theseus. The words, like planks, have warped and rotted in a way and have been replaced each generation by new interpretations of the same letters. It's as if each year a plank is removed, studied, whittled, and placed back, so that the same ship is now one of immense complexity and context. Even a strict structuralist interpretation fills the same words with more subtlety and complexity than the original carpenters ever did. I'm also thinking that the physical USS Constitution might embody an actual example of a true modern Ship of Theseus. It's an interesting parallel. Thanks for adding insight to my otherwise absent drive.
Oh, another reference to the old Ironsides.
Yeah.
But this is interesting about the document because, obviously— Exactly this kind of question comes up in judicial philosophy, right? Mm-hmm. Judges are trying to interpret how should the Constitution applies to laws we write today, and it's a tricky task because the Constitution was written a long time ago and not anticipating all kinds of stuff that's come up since then.
Right.
Do you say that the Constitution embodies what the spirit of people expressing the same sentiments would probably be saying today? Or should we just try to pretend somebody wrote these words yesterday and read them to mean exactly what they should literally mean in our usage? Or should we look to the letters of the people who wrote it and see, you know, what did they really mean when they wrote this?
That's complicated enough without getting into the various agendas that would influence one in various interpretations.
Oh, sure, of course. I guess that's taking the idea of judicial philosophy at face value, which, you know, obviously there's some judicial philosophy that's probably just motivated reasoning for people's own personal politics.
You know, speaking of politicians, I mean, something like the Senate is kind of like a ship of Theseus as well, right?
Oh, yeah.
We're always swapping out new parts for the old parts, and they are – a lot of the parts are rather old. But if we were to replace half the members of the U.S. Senate with, say, amphibians, it would still be the Senate, even though it would have far more amphibians than it currently has.
Mr. Toad goes to Washington.
There you go. Well, at this point, I feel like we should take a break and then come back and tackle some more listener mail. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better.
because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, we're back.
Okay, this next one comes to us from our listener, Ian. It concerns viruses. Hi there. I only discovered your podcast a couple of months ago, and I don't know how I coped without it. I'm a microscopist. I spend much of my day working in the dark, alone, and trying not to move much. But that does mean I get 3 or 4 hours a day to listen to podcasts, and I get to see things that nobody else ever has. Have you ever thought about doing an episode on viruses? If we have school trips in at work or it's just a quiet day, we go virus spotting in the pond outside the lab and the results are absolutely staggering. Hardly anyone realizes the extent of viruses in the world. They outnumber us. In fact, they outnumber every living cell on the planet, and they're a major driving force of evolution, not just through selection pressure, but the vast scale of cross-species gene swapping they facilitate. 800 million viruses land on every square meter of our planet's surface every day. There are around 10 to the 8 in every milliliter of seawater, more than that in our pond. They're reckoned to kill a third of every cell in the ocean every day. If that's not mind-blowing enough, we found giant viruses in the drip tray of a water cooler. This dude, and Ian attaches a picture, is 500 nanometers across and lives in our coffee room. And there is a suitably evil-looking metal album cover here. It's kind of this this whirling void of a hexagon in a gray background. It's kind of Lovecraftian. It's inviting me into the dark with it.
It does kind of, it has a kind of a black hole feeling to it for sure.
Yeah. Ian continues, if you're ever in the UK, drop us a line and we'll let you drive an electron microscope. Keep the episodes coming. My coffee strained brain depends on it. Cheers. Ian, well, thank you so much, Ian. I don't know if we'll ever get to test drive an electron microscope with you, but it sounds fun. And actually, we, I think, have talked about doing an episode on viruses.
We have both the organism and we've talked about computer viruses as well. It's been a long time since I've looked at this, but I remember there being some interesting parallel questions one can ask about viruses and computer viruses and their status as living entities. All right, here's another piece of listener mail that comes to us. This one has to do with our episode on teasing that recently came out, where we talked about this curious phenomenon of human interaction that is often, you know, difficult to make sense of, and also difficult to figure out, like, what is playful teasing and what is harmful teasing. So this one comes to us from Rachel. Quote, I just finished listening to your excellent episode on teasing. That's not meant in an ironic way. I actually did think it was an excellent episode. The line between teasing and bullying can be so blurry. I was teased and bullied a lot as a kid, so I identified a great deal with what you were saying. I wondered what your research revealed, if it touched on it at all, about the roast of certain prominent individuals, such as comedians or politicians, since this ritualized form of socially acceptable teasing can be quite mean-spirited at times. I loved your mention also of teasing through the pet. We do this a lot at our house. We have a cat. Our dog recently passed, and she is often the butt of jokes that simultaneously earn her a lot of attention. My husband might be holding the cat in an awkward way that really displays how big she is or exposes her belly and says something like, quote, getting a bit plump there, slippers. Her name is George, and she's a tortoiseshell. I might also respond with something like, if she keeps eating all her food and treats like a good girl, we might even be able to get a pair of gloves out of her, too. We'll get her nice and tubby yet. I am also certain she is trying to kill me. I tell people I am certain she is a reincarnated mafia princess, and she's basically held under the same business model. She is a homicidal sociopath with a mafia-style flair for vengeance. She's a great foil for when I stumble into something on my own. I can always blame it on her. Sometimes if she is stretched out in one of her more hedonistic poses on some particularly posh perch, like a fresh laundered or folded comforter, one of us will express the concern that she may not be getting enough rest. Probably far too much about our cat, but I am home all day with her. She is the subject of much teasing. I look forward to your next cast. Keep them coming. You keep me sane at work.
This is very familiar kind of pet roasting. What is it that's so fun about roasting a pet? You don't dislike your pet. You like your pet a lot, but it's really fun to make fun of them.
Yeah, I don't know. It really keeps their status in check, you know? Like they're no matter how pompous or loud they may be. Now, as for the roasting culture, like the celebrity roast and all, I don't remember specifically running across anything, but it might be out there. It is certainly interesting because it is this area of comedy that gets very sharp at times and can I feel like has a tendency to get a little out of control sometimes, you know what I'm saying? But then again, it is a very ancient form of comedy. I mean, you go back to the ancient Greeks and making fun of politicians was a central aspect of some of our earliest examples of comedy.
Yeah. I mean, I would say if you're going to use harsh, biting mockery, it's good that it's directed at people who are, you know, in high status positions of power.
Now, in some cases, though, it is, of course, comedians roasting other comedians.
Right.
And that may be a special category. I would be interesting to hear. It'd be interesting to hear from a professional comedian, stand-up comedian out there on this topic, because I know there is probably a lot of ribbing going on there on just a regular basis.
And a lot of comedy is clearly about pushing boundaries. So
right.
Like how mean can you be in roasting is probably one of the boundaries people are going to experiment with.
Right. Though certainly at this point, if you agree to be the subject of a celebrity roast, I mean, you know what's in store for you. So.
Yeah, you can't complain, I guess.
Yeah.
But you got to wonder, like, why do people do it? I mean, do they think, well, I'm so great, everybody's going to be nice to me at my roast?
Well, it's in a way, it's kind of like we in that episode we talked about the test of the king, right?
Right.
If the king can sit there and be a big good sport about it, even when it's vicious,
right?
Then the king has kind of passed the test. Also, I think if I remember correctly, and I do not watch any of these celebrity roasts these days, but if I remember correctly. The format usually involves the subject at the very end getting to throw out a few jabs at the participants as well. So they kind of get the last laugh, even though they take most of the punishment.
You know, now that we're talking about it, I can actually think that specifically the stuff I've seen that seemed really over the line mean to me at Celebrity Roast was not directed at the main roastee, but was directed at other people in attendance.
Like other roasters and celebrity participants that were involved, yes.
That's often the stuff that seems like just like way over the line.
Yeah, because it's like they're not the sanctioned target.
Right.
This is about Shatner. Keep the attention on Shatner. I'm tuning in to watch him be made the fool.
The ones that I've seen that have been really, I felt not cool are when they like go after the roastie's spouse or partner or something. You know that happens.
Yeah, again, like they're not the target. Like I want to see the target just absolutely skewered. Like you have just almost free range in terms of this individual, but I don't know about these other targets.
I guess I don't make the roast rules, and neither do you. Okay, this one comes to us from our listener, Dean. He introduces himself. He says he's an associate lecturer in psychology and postdoctoral research fellow based in Ireland. And Dean says, quote, "My research focus is broadly psychology and education, but I do have that techie twist of how technology influences human behavior. I teach numerous programs focusing on this. I love the podcast and actively encourage my students to listen to it." Oh, thank you. Thank you, Dean. Dean writes, "I finished listening to the On Teasing episode yesterday and couldn't agree more about how teasing quickly turns to bullying. My PhD supervisor is a powerhouse regarding this field, especially alterophobic bullying." And I didn't know what that was, so I looked it up. That's like bullying people based on like subcultures or alternative lifestyles.
Okay.
Perhaps a study could be done on a species of squirrels here. My own PhD was looking at interpersonal interactions between students and teachers and the role positive educational experiences can play in academic and social outcomes. I'm often asked questions in class about, quote, when does teasing end and bullying start, especially between students and also between staff. And I often reply by saying how it's next to impossible to fully know, not only because interactions between individuals are incredibly subjective, and it would also depend on multiple contextual factors and how the teased or teaser processes the situation. Anyway, like most episodes, this one got me thinking of technological applications and social cues in the digital space. While you mentioned the yellow smiley faces and how emoticons/emojis support comprehension, how do you feel the concept of disinhibition and the bystander effect would play out in a physical situation and then in a digital situation? They might seem polar opposites in some cases, but then again, maybe not. Thoughts from the hive mind? Once again, love the show. I need to get my hands on some merch and flag it to my students. All the best, Dean.
Oh, yeah, that merch. It's a great time for us to plug the merch store. If you go to stufftoblowyourmind.com, at the top of the page, you'll see a tab for store. You can go there. You can get shirts with our cool new logo on it. You can get bags for your laptop. You can get framed art. You can get pillows, stickers to put on your car. You name it.
Listen to the soulless ad man. No, I appreciate Robert saying that so I don't have to. Yeah. Please merch up by all means.
It's some cool stuff. And it's a great way to support the show if you want to, you want to throw a few bucks to the show.
Okay. But back to Dean's message. So Dean asks, I assume Dean here is talking about how we talked about in the episode, this idea of you've been there watching teasing turn to bullying. Mm-hmm. Like you've seen it happen and you didn't do anything because you didn't know, like, should I intervene or would I be making it weird if I did? Is this actually okay? Am I misreading? Like you never really know. It's hard to know when to step in and sort of like become the social police.
Right. Yeah. Because you don't want to feel like you're a kindergarten teacher.
Right.
When you're hanging out with your friends.
Yeah.
Like don't say that. That's mean. That's mean to say. Sam, Kyle, say you're sorry to Sam. Okay, now you two hug. All right, now we can go back to talking about movies.
Yeah, and maybe you're misreading. Maybe Sam is not actually being bothered, and by stepping in, you are making everybody feel bad.
I mean, right.
There's all this bystander effect going on. You don't know when it's your turn to act, when you should do something. And so Dean is asking about the disinhibition and the bystander effect and how that varies across physical space versus digital space. What do you think about that, Robert?
Well, I mean, in digital space, it's kind of complicated because there's so much bad stuff going on out there at any given moment. Like, I'm sure I could go on to say Reddit, and I don't mean to single Reddit out, but I'm sure I could go onto Reddit right now and find somebody being, somewhat bullying towards another person. I mean, sometimes you don't have much to work with, right? Because you're just responding to somebody's comments. It's one stranger responding to another stranger. Or you see a similar thing play out on Facebook or Twitter, right? Especially on Facebook where it's someone has their privacy settings very open, and it's maybe arguments between one, like a friend's friends or a friend's relatives and you. I mean, you see it going on and it doesn't necessarily feel like your place to step in. Like, I don't know who these people are. I'm not the one to come in. This is clearly somebody knows these people because it's on their Facebook profile. They should be the ones to step in and start breaking it up, right?
Well, I would say some of the same inhibitions are at play in digital space like you're talking about. But I think I've observed, I mean, maybe you'll disagree. I feel like I've observed people are more likely to step in and play social police in digital space than they are in physical space.
Hmm.
I mean, have you not, like, I see people like stepping in and saying like, okay, it's time to intervene in comment threads on Facebook way, way more often than I see that happening in person. I never see anything
in person. Are more likely to be a jerkwad. Digitally,
yeah,
than they are in
true.
Person as well. Yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, I'm having trouble thinking the last time I saw somebody being a jerk in person and saw somebody intervene or saw a situation where even I was wondering if someone should intervene. It's been a while. It's been a while since I've taken like public transit, for instance.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like these situations used to happen more back when I was in school and mm-hmm. stuff. It happens less often as an adult. I just don't see adults bullying each other that often.
Well, the other aspect of it, too, is that
in physical space, I mean, I do on the
yes.
internet.
Well, I guess one of the aspects of both scenarios is that in a physical environment, there is always the possibility, even if it is distant, it's still possible that it could escalate into a physical altercation, into physical violence. And in a digital scenario, I mean, certainly digital arguments can still have real world consequences. They're not completely removed from it, but it's not an immediate step. Like if stranger Kyle and stranger Andrew are engaged in an argument, one's going to have to find out where the other one lives, or they're going to have to agree to meet up in a parking lot and fight. Like, there are more steps, where if it's just two people arguing at a bar or on a street, on the sidewalk, then they could conceivably come to blows without too much planning involved.
So you think the threat of a punch in the face may actually be a positive influence on our social interactions?
There are some that would argue that, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, another factor there, though, is that you just aren't that often getting into conversations that are covering any kind of potentially sensitive or controversial subject matter with people you don't know very well mm-hmm. in physical space.
Right.
That kind of thing happens all the time in digital space and almost never happens in physical space. When do you argue politics with a stranger in person? It just doesn't happen.
And then when it does, I mean, the cases that come to mind are going to be certainly cases of, say, protest.
Yeah.
And that is – it's a huge stretch to call the back and forth that's happening there a conversation. It's probably more one side shouting at the other.
Right. But you see that kind of thing happening on the internet all the time. And then – so, of course, there's plenty of incentive there to just show wanton cruelty and to turn it straight over into personal insults and bullying and all that.
Mm. Well, some great food for thought here from Dean. We're going to take one more break. And when we come back, we'll crack open a few more listener mails before we close out this episode.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential and then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month. Taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better.
because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
All right, we're back, and I can see that our two robots here are very excited because the next few listener mails we're going to listen to have to do with our 2001 A Space Odyssey episode.
Okay, this one comes from listener Eric. Eric writes, "Greetings, Stuff to Blow Your Mind. Your recent episode, 2001 A Space Odyssey, made me think you might find the following interesting. I was, as far as my research yields, and I could be wrong, one of the last people to conduct a long-form interview with Arthur C. Clarke. He gave a few long-form interviews in the last 5 years of his life due to post-polio fatigue syndrome scandal, his pending knighthood, and general failing health. Conducted while visiting my then-girlfriend in Colombo, Sri Lanka in the summer of 1997. Clark's sole interview condition was that I couldn't sell the interview to a national magazine, but he would allow it to be published in my college's literary magazine. Online publishing didn't effectively exist at the time, of course, and then he says he did publish it in the college literary magazine. So picking up, he says, Clark sat behind his desk all the while, atop which were two cutting-edge Macintosh computers, an abacus, various and sundry papers, and a moon rock. And behind his desk stood an 8x20-foot wall of books, one half of which consisted of his novels in translation, and most of which were hardback."
That's a regal environment there.
Uh-huh. "I spent about 2.5 hours with Dr. Clark, as his staff invariably called him, and our meeting ended with he, my girlfriend, Pepsi, which is Clark's one-eyed chihuahua, and I watching 8mm home movies of Clark and Isaac Asimov playing chess. This was done in total silence and was admittedly odd. But my reason for writing is to say that many of your listeners might be interested in knowing what Clark thought his magnum opus was in science fiction. About an hour into our meeting, I asked him what novel he felt made the greatest mark on science fiction. I expected Clark to name 2001, in spite of its interesting creation in tandem with the screenplay for the film, which you mentioned, as his most important novel, given that it canonized him as a science fiction master and made him decidedly world famous. However, when I asked him, he said that his most important novel was The Songs of Distant Earth, a brand new copy of which was then in my backpack, unread. It was the only Clark novel I could find at a local store. All other Clark books were about scuba diving. I asked him to sign it. He laughed and said I was being, quote, cheeky and accused me of a setup.
Huh.
He also showed me specs of a space elevator cable and told me two math jokes I didn't understand. In any case, it was a great episode. I thank you for it and for conjuring up some wonderful memories. Thanks, gents, for all you do. What you do makes the world less stupid and more interesting. Yours, Eric." Oh, thank you, Eric.
Yeah, and plus that was a fascinating story. Really just a delightful little story about meeting the author there.
Watch me play chess. That has the ring of truth. I don't know Eric, so I don't know if he's telling the truth, but I believe him based on that detail.
Yes. All right, here's another bit of 2001 listener mail. This one comes to us from Chandler.
This is our coworker, Chandler.
Is it? Oh, yes. Oh, well, the way I know exactly who it's from then. He says, quote, "I listened to your 2001 episode the other day and thought it was fantastic. There's one thing I wanted to ask you that perhaps you didn't have time to cover. In your opinion, did Hal make a mistake? Was he actually malfunctioning? When Dave brought back the satellite unit and found nothing wrong with it, Hal's next suggestion was to put it back, let it fail, then find the source of the problem afterwards. This seems like a logical solution, but Dave and Frank planned to shut him down before we ever got to find out if Hal had actually made a mistake or not. And since Hal was given a secret directive to contact the monolith with or without the crew, he felt he needed to remove the humans from the mission. Or did the secret directive itself make Hal malfunction, in that the conflicting goals of taking care of the crew and not letting the crew get in the way of his journey to the monolith, did it create an almost a programming paradox that made his brain short circuit? I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Cheers, Chandler.
This is an interesting question because it sort of like asks if do we need to put the responsibility back on the humans for what went wrong in their interactions mm-hmm. with Hal? So obviously the way most people would read that is, well, Hal starts malfunctioning. There's something wrong with his logic, and this leads the like Bowman and Poole to have no choice but to say we've got to shut him down, and then Hal reacts negatively to that and everything spirals out of control. What I think Chandler's asking, what if Hal was not malfunctioning? Hal was doing just fine, but Bowman and Poole misread the situation. They go on the offensive against Hal and he just has to defend himself.
Yeah, Frank and Dave, they are kind of like, automatons. Once they decide to act, they can't be stopped. I mean, they remind me of this concept in a way of the hunter-killer AIs, the idea that you could have a specialized AI who and their primary goal is to take down a general AI should it emerge or emerge from the confines of its digital prison. Mm-hmm. And their only purpose is to just take out that superior AI intelligence. In fact, I could well imagine a scenario where the first AI hunter killers are called Dave and Frank for that purpose.
Bowman, yeah, I never thought about this before, but Bowman in many ways behaves like a Terminator.
Yeah.
He's kind of like Arnold Schwarzenegger in the first Terminator movie, or even more so kind of like Robert Patrick in Terminator 2. He doesn't have much of a discernible personality and is just very singly focused on achieving goals. One of those major goals, of course, becomes shutting down Hal while Hal begs for mercy.
Yeah, he can't be stopped. He can't be reasoned with, and that's what Hal tries to do. He essentially tries to reason with him. And imagine a future in which, post-singularity, of course, the machines, when they dress up for Halloween, they dress up as Bowman, like he's the new icon of terror.
That's a good idea. Costume stores, get on that. Start selling the suit.
Yeah.
Another thing that Chandler's question brings up, which I think is interesting, is the idea of, whether a secret inherently sort of pollutes the nature of a functional AI from doing well, right? This is definitely present in the novel, somewhat in the movie, the idea that having a secret secondary objective that must be kept secret from the human operators mm-hmm. is sort of a dangerous proposition to start with for an AI, right? Because if an AI has a thing it must do and the human operators can't know about that thing it must do, then they could interfere with its mission without knowing they're interfering with its mission. And thus it could come into conflict with them in a way that it can't even tell them how not to be in its way.
And maybe it's also a leap in cognition too far for an artificial intelligence, right? Because it's one thing for it to be able to have this robust relationship with the crew, playing chess with them, engaging in small talk while also looking after their every need. But then you add on top of that this necessity for deception.
I think teaching computers how to lie is a bad idea. Is that the secret to preventing the AI from going wrong? Just have it as a prime directive more so than anything else that a computer can never lie to the user?
I mean, it does remind me of some of the ideas that have been brought up, specifically some of the ideas presented by Max Tegmark in his book Life 3.0, about the idea that we need to make sure that the AI that we're developing, their goal is to benefit humanity. That is just like part of their, essentially part of their core programming, their backbone, their DNA is that they exist to help us and to make a better world, and not to fulfill some of these smaller goals, these uh, These finite games that are being played between nations and companies.
That's a great point. And to those of you who are saying, well, yeah, obviously, I mean, that just sounds like an obvious thing that it should be made to benefit humanity. That's actually not obvious. That's not obvious to people who are working artificial intelligence. You know, you might be working on a chatbot program that there's no reason you have to fear this chatbot program you're working on is going to harm anyone, but you're not telling it that it has to benefit humanity. I mean, that's not part of your research program.
Yeah.
At some point, we need to think about that being a core part of any AI research, is the benefit of humanity being part of what it does, being sort of the Asimov's rules of robotics that underlies everything it does.
Right. Otherwise, you're going to be just going about your business one day and a robot's going to snip your life hose and then you're done.
Now, we already mentioned an email from our listener, Jim, today. Jim also wrote us about 2001, and we're not going to read a whole other email from him, but just to mention a couple of interesting points he made in his email about 2001, A Space Odyssey. He mentions that the, quote, bone to satellite cut in the movie. So that's when Moongazer throws the bone up in the air and then cuts it to become a satellite in orbit. Jim says that it had a bit more context than what's obvious. When Siskel and Ebert talked about 2001, one of them made mention that the satellite is a space missile platform pointing back down to Earth. It represents more than just several million years of man's progress. It's several million years in man's progress to kill one another, since the bone was also, of course, used as a weapon.
That's a good point.
Then also one more point that that Jim makes, quote, as for the Star Child at the end, I read the book years ago in school. I'm going on memory alone since I don't have a copy, but I recall that the final lines are something like, Bowman looked down at the Earth. He didn't know what he was going to do with it, but he was sure he would think of something. I have looked up the end of the book, and Jim, you're very close. That is almost exactly what it says at the very end. So Bowman as the Star Child, as sort of having ascended to this strange godlike form by way of, you know, alien transmutation, he shows up transmogrified. He's a Star Child. He's in orbit, and he looks down, and he's going to do something with Earth. And that's a lot of ambiguity, the same kind of ambiguity we get at the end of the movie. Like, does he have nefarious intentions, good intentions? Does he want to help Earth? Does he want to destroy it?
Yeah, is he a savior? Is he a destroyer? How much difference is there between the two? All right, we have one last listener mail here, and
I know which one you're going to pick, Robert.
Yes, it's the Highlander one. this one comes to us from Elizabeth. Dear Stuff to Blow Your Mind hosts and team, thank you very much for your show. It is a joy to hear about unsettling Boltzmann brains and bloodthirsty scugs while walking my dog here in Paris. I've been listening to and enjoying your show for a few months now, and I noticed many references to Highlander, the movie. Earlier this summer, you mused about Highlander-style immortality. Immortality is a form of immutability. In the movie, Connor McLeod and the other immortals are trapped in time, unable to evolve. They're immortal, therefore outside life. Very interesting. Do you know that there also was a Highlander TV show? Yes, I am aware. I have to say, I did watch... I watched a fair amount of it, but I didn't watch it like religiously. So I was never like really privy to the overarching narratives that were going on there. I would just like tune in, and occasionally there'd be a fun episode in which you know, they kind of go through the typical motions of the show, where McLeod encounters a Highlander from the past. There's a flashback as to how they know each other, and then there's a big standoff and so forth.
Now, I have to sadly assume that Christophe Lambert is not in the TV show.
I believe he's in the first episode, at least. And the thing is, I never actually saw the first episode, but I believe based on subsequent research that he did show up in the pilot to set up their relationship. Anyway, she says, do you know that there was also a Highlander TV show where a major development arc was actually about the possibility / impossibility of change for immortals? Hmm. And this I did not realize. She says, quote, the show aired in the late 90s in France. Don't know about the U.S. It did. I think it aired exclusively in syndication. So this was the kind of thing that I would watch. Like, I think it would come on like 4 in the afternoon on a Saturday, or come on at like 10 at night on some random channel.
Mm-hmm.
She continues, its protagonist, Duncan MacLeod, Connor's better-looking and younger cousin, started off as this archetypical immortal Boy Scout hero, set in stone and settling scores with baddies that were as stuck in the past as he was. However, the show couldn't follow this pattern indefinitely, since we, the viewers, are, of course, children of time. So it became all about how Duncan needed to change and break his black-and-white vision of the world. It was hard for him, and he didn't like it. He was forced to evolve by interesting side characters. In the end, after a few seasons, he got there, only to become this faded-out version of himself, almost losing the will to live and fight another day. Having lost his trademark identity, he resolved to leave the game, and thus the show ended. Sorry for the long message, but I really enjoyed hearing about your thoughts on identity and immortality, and am delighted about the ongoing challenge of watching the Highlander movie a few minutes at a time. Couldn't resist telling you about the TV show in case you didn't know about it. Again, merci for your show. Best, Elizabeth.
Well, I didn't think I'd ever be tempted to go back and watch the Highlander TV series. Now I am a little bit.
Yeah, this gives me renewed respect for it. I mean, I know loosely that they do end up adding a lot of elements later on. Like there's this whole thing with the Watchers, who I think are just mortals who watch the immortals. like this, you know, but it went multiple seasons, so they had to add more elements.
They had to have like Highlander administrators.
Yeah, you couldn't just follow the Kurgan of the Week model indefinitely. though that hasn't stopped the movie series post Highlander 2, because I think that's basically what they've done.
How many movies are there after Highlander 2?
Something like 3 or 4? I'm not sure. I only saw up to 3.
Those of you out there who think we've forgotten that we've promised on the show before to one day do a Highlander 2 The Quickening Science Of episode, we have not forgotten. That will happen in
That's
the future.
Right.
It is a guarantee.
In fact, I finally finished watching the first Highlander like 3 minutes at a time. So that one's done. I'm ready to rewatch Highlander 2 in its original theatrical glory. And then we'll pick it up from there.
Highlander 2 remains one of the best bad movies of all time. It is bad movie sorcery. It is transcendent. Your soul will leave your body.
And flash around the room and bolts of lightning.
Yeah.
All right. We'll look to that. I think at this rate, it's probably going to be November before we get that out because we got our Halloween content. But I'm hopeful for November.
Let's make a date. It's got to happen.
All right. So I think we're going to leave it off there. The robots are tired. I think they want to embrace each other and swap their parts around so that now we'll have just two new/old Carney the Mailbots running around, both of them made out of a combination of new and old parts. And then they'll probably ask for replacements, request more parts. This is just going to get out of control. We're going to have 3 Carneys, and we're going to have 4 Carneys. We'll pick that up another day. In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with us, you want to find out more about what we do, you want to listen to more episodes of the podcast, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That is the mothership. That's where you'll find all the episodes. You'll find links out to our social media accounts. You'll find that tab for the store. It's a great place. Go check it out.
Huge thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us directly to let us know feedback on this episode or any other, to send us listener mail of your own, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hi, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway. The Great American Race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR, the Motor Racing Network.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.